Support for The World's Podcast comes from LegalZoom. With over 17 years and more than 2 million customers, LegalZoom provides helpful support, legal advice, and transparency for business owners. More information at LegalZoom.com/world.
The caste system here in America, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. India's caste system can keep people in their place even after they leave the country. An Indian-American man revisits his homeland and sees the system he never fully escaped.
And I could see they are doing exactly like what my father was doing, and they have very limited future options.
Also, the U.S. Census is coming next year with some new measures to protect privacy.
As far as I know, this is the first time anybody's tried to do this.
But will that be enough to reassure undocumented people that it's safe for them to come fill out a census form? And a breakthrough against HIV, researchers explain what a cure would mean for millions of people living with the disease.
Something that's less dramatic may well allow us to keep people well off antiretroviral therapy longer term.
Those stories and more on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for joining us today. In America, there are a lot of democratic concepts we aim to live up to. E pluribus unum, united we stand, one nation, indivisible. And yet there are so many things that divide us these days. Race and religion, gender, class and wealth. Let me also add another form of social division that's rarely discussed in the United States, one that's especially relevant for Indian Americans, caste. Today, we bring you the first story in our series, Caste in America. It's a collaboration with WGBH Radio and the Pulitzer Center, looking at what caste is and how harmful the system of social hierarchy can be. We begin today in India. My WGBH colleague Philip Martin traveled there with an Indian man from the Boston area who began his life in India as a so-called untouchable.
After an 18-hour flight from Boston, we're minutes away from landing in the Indian state of Maharashtra, and I'm sitting next to Suraj Yangde. He's visiting his home country and returning to a system called caste, where Suraj Yangde is a Dalit, or a so-called untouchable, so low within the caste system that it is considered an outcast. Suraj Yangde's family and friends greet him with flowers and effusive smiles, fitting for a Dalit in their view, who has accomplished what many here call the near impossible for an untouchable, not merely for leaving India, but for becoming a lawyer, a PhD, and a fellow at Harvard University, no less. When we get to Yangde's house, he shows me around and points to the roof, where water would come through when it rained when he was a kid.
One day it rained, I saw my mom trying to put three buckets in different locations so the water drops don't fall on us. My entire life I slept like this without realizing that mom and dad were dancing the whole night so that the waters don't fall on us and we might get distracted from our sleep in order to go to school next day.
But not just to any school. Yangde's parents enrolled him at a Christian school here where caste mattered, but mattered far less than in government institutions. His grades served as a gateway to higher education in Mumbai, and from there, to going abroad.
Now, if you don't go, what happens? Once the student graduates from his 12th grade, look around. When the guys who I grew up with, they knew I was here, they all came up to talk to me. And I could see they are doing exactly like what my father was doing, and they have very limited future options.
Many liken casteism to American segregation in the South, but that comparison is far too simple. Caste in India is so much older, by about 3,000 years. It's also enshrined in religion. Dalits in many towns and villages in India and Nepal are expected to drink from separate water fountains, to eat at separate lunch and dinner counters away from upper caste Indians. They're buried in separate graves for fear they'll pollute the air, and they often live in segregated neighborhoods like this one.
Drinking water?
Yeah.
That's drinking water?
Yeah, that's drinking water pipe.
Drainage line.
Drinking water next to a sewage line.
This is a tap water that the municipality provides.
Walking through the neighborhood, Yangde points to white plastic tubing that supplies drinking water for 20,000 or so outcasts, squeezed into a slum the size of Fenway Park. The tubing runs parallel on the surface of a foul-smelling sewer, clogged with human waste and discarded bits of everything.
you can see all kinds of stuff being dumped here because people don't have any other place to dump. So plastics, food waste, all goes into this. These are the people who clean it.
It's expected, says this man, Namdi Opawar, who lives here.
Caste is primarily an occupation-based system. You are given the position in the job hierarchy, what kind of job you have to do. And so the filthiest or the lowest considered jobs were given to the untouchable population. And their ancestors and their ancestors and on have been doing the same job. Cleaning the human filth with the bare hands.
And Dalits are pushing back. Here and across India, former untouchables are protesting the deaths of hundreds of workers who have perished while cleaning sewers, breathing in methane, and slipping and falling in the dark. They also have demonstrated against sexual violence against Dalit women by upper caste men and an uptick in lynchings in recent years. Yangde says that even a guy with a Harvard pedigree is still on the lowest rung.
It crushes the heart, but even today, I'm still an untouchable. My primary identity, for some reason, is not going away.
Back at Yangde's house, his PhD, law, and master's diplomas hang on the damp wall, alongside photos of his now deceased father and of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. Ambedkar is a Dalit hero who, like Yangde, studied in the UK and the US. He also created India's Affirmative Action Program, which today sets aside 25% of government jobs and university placements for Dalits and lower caste Indians. The reservation policy, as it's called, has provoked resentment among some upper caste Indians, but was a turning point for Suraj Yangde. It's a full house at the university here near Yangde's childhood home. Hundreds of people have turned out to hear him advise students on how to get to school in the U.S. He tells them to improve their English, get good grades, and take advantage of India's flawed but hard-fought-for affirmative action program. He also tells folks to take pride in their ancestry and in their Dalit names. Names can signal one's caste in India, but one student here admits that his family has tried to mask their identity.
My father changed our surname because of caste discrimination in India, because people can identify his surname, and that's why my father changed my surname.
But he still faces discrimination, he says. Another student raises his hand and asks the question that Yangde seems well prepared to answer. If he makes it to the United States, he asks, will his caste follow? Yes, says Yangde, like a shadow. For The World, Philip Martin.
Philip's story was produced in partnership with WGBH and the Pulitzer Center. Tomorrow, we meet a couple who married in India across caste lines.
His family said, I may have performed some black magic to make him fall for me.
50 years ago, Indira was in medical school when she fell in love with a fellow med student. His family is from a higher caste.
I told them, listen, you know, I don't care about what all these relatives are talking about. I love her. I want to marry her. You may not like it. I'm sorry. If you don't like it, you can go to hell.
They made the choice to marry for love. Now, years later, their American daughter tells us what it's like being in a family that crosses caste lines. That's tomorrow. There's another reason India is in the news today. That's because President Trump, who likes to describe himself as a tariff man, looks to be opening a new front in his global trade war. China is Exhibit A. The president hit the Chinese with $250 billion in tariffs. Now President Trump is saying that India is ripping us off. The U.S. has a trade deficit in goods with India of about $20 billion a year. Trump wants to cut into that. The World's Jason Margolis covers trade and economics for our program. Let's start at the very beginning, do a little trade 101 for dummies like me. What is a tariff?
Okay. A tariff is a tax on imports. So let's say you have a company. What kind of company have you always wanted to have?
How about a sailboat company?
All right. You have sailboats and you need life vests for your sailboats. Those vests cost $100. You get them from Italy and we have a 20% tariff on those vests. So now you're paying $120. The idea is to encourage you to buy locally because you will save that 20%.
So, Jason, remind us what tariffs the Trump administration has already put on our trading partners.
We have tariffs on washing machines, solar panels, steel, aluminum, and a lot of tariffs, as you mentioned, on thousands of goods coming in from China.
So, Jason, what are Trump's plans for India tariff-wise now?
So India, as well as most developing nations, are under what's called the Generalized System of Preferences.
Yeah, what is that?
Basically, what it's saying is if you're a developing country, you can sell your goods to Europe or the United States, and you won't be hit with tariffs on thousands of items. You can essentially export duty-free to the U.S. and Europe. It's a break. It's saying, we want you, developing nation in Africa, Asia, wherever, we want you to join the global nation of trading countries. We want your economies to grow. And President Trump has said, you know what, India, you're no longer a developing nation. You don't need this break anymore. And it's gone. India has said, okay, fine, we're not going to argue. They say it's only a small amount. It only saved us about $190 million a year, which is just a drop in the bucket of U.S.-India trade.
So why is Trump going after India now? Are they no longer a developing nation? Are they fully developed?
Well, there are a lot of problems between India and the United States. There are some issues that need to be resolved. Trump says that India is not allowing U.S. companies into some markets. India says the United States is not giving enough high-tech visas. But Trump seems to be particularly fixated on Harley-Davidson motorcycles. And he's been fixated on this for at least a year. And here he is talking this weekend at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Maryland.
So I say India is a very high-tariff nation. They charge us a lot. When we send a motorcycle to India, it's 100% tariff. They charge 100%. When India sends a motorcycle to us, we brilliantly charge them nothing.
So you can hear the gasps in the audience. You know, how can this be? They're charging us 100% to sell a motorcycle over there, and we let their motorcycles come in for nothing. Well, let me ask you a question. How many people do you know here in the United States who ride motorcycles that are made in India?
I don't know anybody. I don't even know what the brands are.
Right. India sells less than 1,000 motorcycles each year in the United States. And Harley-Davidson is selling a little less than 3,000 in India. And those motorcycles are made in India. So they're not even subject to the tariff. And one other thing to mention, President Trump likes to say there's a 100% tariff on U.S. motorcycles going into India. It's actually 50% tariff. So there's a lot misleading. But Trump talks about this motorcycle tariff over and over and over. It's just not that big of a deal.
So, you know, Jason, what is Trump trying to get out of all of this?
The cynical view is Trump is trying to get a marketing win. He wants to say, look what I did. I opened up India. And if he can say, I opened it up to Harley-Davidsons, even though there's 3,000 Harley-Davidsons being sold in India that are already being built in India, he can still market it as a win. That's the cynical viewpoint.
There's been, as we've reported on The World, escalating geopolitical tensions between India and Pakistan. Should we be paying attention to the timing of these tariffs?
That is a good question, and that is one which, truthfully, I can't give you a good answer to, because is this just a trade spat that's been going on for a year and President Trump announced this today in spectacularly bad timing, or is he trying to get some leverage over India? That depends on who you ask, but there are issues that India and the United States need to work out. They're both concerned, for example, about growing aggression of China in the South China Sea, and getting rid of this system of preferential trade treatment for India is just a very, very small part of it. Harley-Davidsons are a very, very small part of the overall relationship between India and the United States. So if I can leave you with one thought, is that this is just a tiny piece of the U.S.-India bilateral relationship. However, symbolically, it's big. It's poking an ally over and over, and India might get tired of that.
The World's Jason Margolis. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up, making a French woman actor officially une actrice, feminizing job titles in the French language. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you're a female teacher or female firefighter in France, up to now, you'd be known as a professeur or a sapeur-pompier, respectively, the job titles for men. Now, a change. Women in those jobs can now officially be called a professeur with an extra E or a sapeuse-pompier. That's because France has finally decided to accept the feminization of job titles. Most European countries did that decades ago. The change was approved by the Académie Française, which previously described the feminine form of various job titles as barbaric. So what happened? Agnès Poirier is a French journalist who produced a BBC documentary about the famous Academy.
What they have done is just to validate something that has been going on in our daily lives for about 20, 30 years. That is to say, a lot of people and a lot of French women have decided just to add an E, for instance, to their métier, you know, to their profession. And newspapers have been doing it for quite a while. So, you know, they just put a stamp, really, on a practice that had been going on for, I would say, for a generation.
Got it. So you're an author, Agnès, an auteur. Will you now officially be an autrice?
Well, you can be an autrice or you can be an auteur with an E at the end. I mean, it's actually, in a way, much easier to add an E because you can write it, but it doesn't change the way you actually pronounce it. So it's much easier. But you can choose to be an autrice now as well. I mean, it works, you know, it's like chef, okay, in French. You can add an E. When you write it, and it doesn't change the way you pronounce it.
Right.
In a way, now, when you write it, you are not making a grammatical or spelling mistake.
Well, it's really interesting. So unofficially, this was used in speech by people in everyday use. It was used by newspapers. Why did it take so long for this to be officialized by the Académie Française?
You know, we tend to get the Académie Française completely wrong because they are only name the guardians of the temple of the French language. Because a language, as they very well know, because they are very clever people and they are not stuffy at all, you know, we are incredibly prejudiced against the Académie Française. And I was, before I embarked on making a documentary about them, I was curious about this institution. We all thought they were just decrepit old white males, and actually they are not.
But it is still largely a white male domain, the Académie Française.
Well, much less than it used to. First of all, there are far many more women today than they used to be. And also it's extremely diverse because they admit within their circle, not only French people, it's people who have made French language the language in which they write or they exert their profession, usually intellectual profession. So for that documentary, I've met with the first English immortel, because they are known as immortal in France, Michael Edwards. Imagine an Englishman in the temple of the French language. Well, it exists.
And what does this Englishman bring to the Académie Française party?
Well, diversity and also a love of the French language that is coming from abroad. Also, there are Lebanese. There's even a Chinese man, a writer, François Cheng, who made the French language is a bit like Nabokov, if you'd like, you know, a bit like Joseph Conrad, a bit like Tolstoy, who all wrote in the French language as well as their own. So it's a diverse community, and also their advice is only advisory, really. So, you know, they are a hardworking bunch. They famously meet on every Thursday to discuss a word because they publish a dictionary. And a language is a living being. So, you know, they cannot rule. They can just say, well, from now on, it will be considered as acceptable. If you've waited for the stamp of approval of the Académie Française, then you're happy. But most people don't wait for them.
Right. I just want to know how important this academy is today in France. Like, who pays attention to it?
You'd be surprised. I mean, in a way, it's the object of mockery. I mean, you have no idea. Within France and, of course, abroad, because it sounds so French and so strange, an institution. But it does perform an incredible service. A lot of people, I would say hundreds every day from all over the world, send emails, or I should say courriel in French, because there is a word for it, and ask questions about the language, about the French language. And I've seen the committee, and they are in attic rooms, very small rooms, and they are very, very interesting people of different origins, but with a common love, the French language, and common knowledge, expert knowledge, and they answer all these emails every day. It's quite wonderful to to see so many emails coming from all over the world asking a question of language or punctuation or grammar. And they reply to all those people.
I mean, it's really nice to pay attention to language and grammar, but does it ever bother you, Agnes, the kind of orthodoxy of the French language? I mean, I speak French pretty well, but sometimes, you know, in Paris, people be like, oh, let me speak English to you because my English is so much better than your French.
Well, you know, the French are quite attached to their language. And if they correct somebody who speaks it very well, it's actually, you should take it as a compliment. They just want you to speak even better than you do. And actually, you know, the first time I arrived in the UK, and I was so cross that the British wouldn't correct my English because I wanted to improve it. And I said, please. And they thought they were being polite. But actually, they prevented me from becoming better at English. So, you know, you may not like it to be corrected, but actually, they are really doing you a favor.
Agnès Poirier, a French journalist, a writer, an autrice now officially. Thanks very much, Agnès.
You're welcome.
It all kind of reminds me of a T-shirt I've seen that says, I'm secretly judging your grammar. Well, here's proof that even in the land of linguistic judgment, there's still lots of heart and soul. This is Frenchman Alexis Evans from Bordeaux. I promise not to go. See that girl I know. She's done me wrong before. Always ask for more. Cause it's over. Yes, it's over. Apparently, wine isn't the only thing that is smooth in the Bordeaux region. Alexis Evans may sound like he's a child of the 60s, but he's 25. It was his father, a musician from the UK, who turned him on to American soul music as a kid. His dad also taught him guitar. That's the short version of the Alexis Evans story. I made a deal with she had some other place to stay. The girl I thought I had made me feel so sad. Cause it's over. Yes, it's over. Some tastiness there from French soul man Alexis Evans. The track is called I Made a Deal With Myself from his CD I've Come a Long Way. It's out later this week. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. We give away our personal info online all the time. But sometimes our own smart devices gather that info without us even knowing it.
And of course, what did Google say? Oh, yeah, sorry, we meant to tell you about that. We apologize.
Monetizing our data and who profits. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The 2020 U.S. Census has been in the news because of the Trump administration's controversial attempt to add a citizenship question. The Supreme Court will rule on that later this year. The issue of privacy is a big concern with that question proposal, especially for non-citizens. They're supposed to take part in the census, too. But what if undocumented people could be identified based on their responses to the census? The World's Rupa Shenoy spoke with the woman whose work may prevent that from happening.
20 years ago, Cynthia Dwork started thinking about what privacy would mean today, in an age when people's personal information is collected in any number of massive databases.
And in fact, in this work, the census was always our primary motivating scenario.
Dwork is a professor of computer science at Harvard and a leading scientist at Microsoft Research. She says when it comes to online databases, the census is the gold standard.
This is the data of the people that's going to be analyzed for the benefit of the people and to distribute the people's resources.
Census data is used not only to allocate money, but also to create legislative districts. So the information has to be accurate, but it can't be so specific that individual people can be identified. By law, the Census Bureau has to protect people's privacy. In the early 2000s, it became clear to Dworck and others that it was going to get tough for the U.S. to maintain that crucial balance. As technology developed, there were more and more ways to reconstruct databases or cross-reference multiple databases, making it easier to identify people.
I think we're limited only by our imagination.
Dworck led an effort to find ways the Census Bureau could release usable information without releasing too much. They developed a solution called differential privacy.
It's a dream of mine to learn how to really explain this so that it's widely accessible.
To put it very crudely, differential privacy applies an algorithm to a data set. The algorithm essentially flips a coin for each individual answer. As a result, you can't be sure how any one person in the data set responded. Like, for example, how an undocumented person responded to a question about their citizenship status.
Differential privacy absolutely protects everybody, including the outliers and the unusual people. In fact, our philosophy was that the outliers, in some intuitive sense, need more protection than everybody else.
And that protection is greatly needed.
Well, thank you all so much. Good morning. It's really my honor to welcome all of you to the CSAC meeting this morning.
At a recent meeting of scientific advisors to the census, the Bureau's chief scientist, John Abaud, said he'd led internal tests that showed the 2010 census could have been compromised. It was possible to identify individuals' age, gender, location, race, and ethnicity.
These experiments confirm that you can very accurately reconstruct what we call the 100% detail file, which is a confidential version of the census, using just the tables we published in 2010 at the person level.
And he said that's why the Census Bureau plans to use differential privacy for the first time for the 2020 census.
As far as I know, this is the first time anybody's tried to do this.
The theory is that differential privacy will guard against threats that exist now and even ones that might be invented in the future.
They're future-proof, which means it makes absolutely no difference what happens from the point of computing power or future releases of data from other sources that can't be compromised, as long as they're implemented correctly.
And that's a hint at the big remaining vulnerability to privacy with the census, the possibility of missteps within the federal government. The scientist advisors seemed especially concerned with the Census Bureau sharing information with other federal agencies and whether those agencies, like the Department of Homeland Security, will respect privacy. Kathy Pettit's an advisor from the Urban Institute.
I'm just thinking about communications around DHS being involved could be misinterpreted that they actually have access to the information.
So I'll be clear on two pieces.
Kevin Smith is the Census's chief information officer. He said that only a small group of staff would have access to sensitive census information, and any data that is shared with other agencies would be encrypted and very limited.
It is things like internet addresses. It is not answers and responses to surveys.
For her part, differential privacy pioneer Cynthia Dworck believes that threats to the census, even those within the federal government, are being addressed.
I think we're in the fortunate situation where we have a Census Bureau that we can trust.
Despite the Trump administration's proposal to include the question about citizenship on the 2020 census.
I understand very well that the citizenship question will frighten people. And I think that it leads to bad statistics as a result, because people don't report. As I understand, the people at the census do not support the inclusion of the citizenship question. This is being imposed on them externally.
If the citizenship question is included, Dworck hopes that the census's use of differential privacy will at least provide the appropriate privacy protection. She fervently hopes that. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
How the Census Bureau and other government agencies secure our personal data is one thing, but you and I are also constantly leaving digital breadcrumbs of private information behind online. Plenty of companies collect that data and turn them into profits. That's the idea explored in a deeply researched new book. Shoshana Zuboff is the author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. She joins us from New York. Shoshana, first of all, what is surveillance capitalism? What makes up the surveillance part? Who's doing it? And who is monetizing the data from the surveillance?
Well, surveillance capitalism claims private human experience. Private human experience is taken, and out of this black box comes predictions. Predictions of what we will do now, soon, and later. And these predictions are then sold to business customers who have an interest in knowing our future behavior.
So what was the most recent example in your own life where surveillance capitalism intervened?
Well, I noticed the other day that, first of all, I have all my location tracking blocked on my laptop and everything I do online, intentionally, as I hope you do. Nevertheless, there was an ad from our local healthcare center where I'd recently had an appointment on my screen. But not only was there an ad for my healthcare center, there was a person featured in that ad who is a friend and a neighbor of mine.
Wow. What was that all about? What do you think that was all about?
I think that they were able to scrape data from my online interactions that gave them a way to target information to me that they thought would be most effective. This is not unique. This is everyday routine, ho-hum, please pass the salt, day in the life of surveillance capitalism.
Who created the concept of surveillance capitalism?
Surveillance capitalism was, you might say, stumbled into but then recognized as a gold mine, first by Google in the 2000-2001 timeframe in the teeth of financial emergency in Silicon Valley during the dot-com bust. There was a moment of truth where the founders who had previously rejected the idea of online advertising, the founders decided that it was going to be advertising that was going to get them back on a road to survival. The company knew that it had behavioral data that was left over from people's search behavior. A few people had been experimenting, and they understood that there was real predictive value in these data. They were already calling their stuff artificial intelligence. So they took these exclusive to them data and they produced a prediction of a piece of future human behavior, Marco. This prediction was what was called the click-through rate, what kinds of ads we are likely to click on.
Mm. I mean, surveillance, the word itself right out of the gate, has a negative connotation. Is the technology a tool like any other tool that can be used for good or for bad? I mean, do you see some optimism on the road ahead?
Let it be known that I am nothing but an optimist, and there are a couple reasons why. First of all, the idea has been perpetrated that these methodologies, this economic logic, is the only way that digital can work. We can have the digital without surveillance capitalism. We can bring the digital back to the trajectory that it was supposed to be on, an emancipatory, service-oriented trajectory. To do that, we don't fight technology, we fight capitalism. And this makes me very optimistic because our democratic societies have a successful history in taming the excesses of a raw, destructive capitalism, tethering it to democratic principles, tethering it to the real needs of our societies.
But can capitalism counter a raw kind of technology that's growing? Because like so much technology, that which makes profit is really hard to put back in the Pandora's box. So how do you fix that?
But again, Marco, I want to stress, it's not the technology that's making profit. It's the way it's being used. It's been hijacked by an economic logic. Back in the year 2000, an auspicious group of data scientists and engineers published a project that they called the Aware Home. It's what we today call the Smart Home. When they presented the schematics for their idea, it was a simple closed loop. And the engineers and data scientists said, this is intimate data. This is data that must be private. So we have a closed loop only belongs to the occupants. Now, fast forward to the year 2017. Two scholars at the University of London did an analysis of one Nest thermostat. Nest is a company that is owned by Google that makes smart home devices. They concluded that if you install one Nest thermostat in your home, you should review a minimum of 1,000 so-called privacy contracts. Because each contract funnels your data to third parties, and they funnel your data to more third parties. Nest takes responsibility for none of it. Therefore, it is no surprise that the Nest security system, it was just revealed, has a secret microphone built into it that was never made transparent to consumers, never made transparent in the schematics of this device. And of course, what did Google say? Oh, yeah, sorry, we meant to tell you about that. We apologize. Which is the typical kind of two-step shuffle that surveillance capitalists do when they're caught red-handed, illegitimately taking our data without our knowledge and therefore without meaningful consent. This is why an important parliamentary committee in the UK that's been investigating Facebook since the Cambridge Analytica revelations a year ago came to the conclusion that Facebook acted as a, quote, digital gangster.
We're with Shoshana Zuboff. She's the author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. I'm just curious, going back to the Nest case, how would Europeans address the Nest situation? Because I don't know if you're aware, in France, there's this device that utilities want to put in people's homes, and there's a big outrage and pushback, this thing called Linky, which essentially would be a utility-installed version of Nest.
Yes. We've got one set of issues when we talk about private surveillance capital. When you put public sector companies or also just the state and state agencies into the mix, we create a whole additional set of problems. Perhaps an even more chilling example is in China, where we see an authoritarian state now commandeering what were once quote-unquote private internet companies, and now we have an authoritarian state saying, we want the data. We want these supply chains. And we want to use these data in order not just to control populations toward commercial outcomes that make companies profitable, but now we want to use these data to control populations toward the social and political outcomes that will allow this regime to endure without resistance. So if we do not reactivate our sleeping democracy to intervene here, we do become vulnerable.
How concerned are you that that is the future? I mean, where does surveillance capitalism go from here? Is it necessarily this very dark place that you describe?
So I'm optimistic because our societies have had experience already in taming raw capitalism and tethering it to our needs. We did that to end the Gilded Age. We did that during the period of the Great Depression. We did that in the post-World War II period. We used our public awareness to insist and compel our elected officials to enact the new laws that would force a raw and violent capitalism into something that could approach an equilibrium with democracy.
Shoshana Zuboff, the author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Great to have you with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco. It's a privilege.
The early years of the AIDS crisis were terrifying, especially for the gay community. But today, excitement, some excitement anyway, over what's being called a cure for HIV. A man referred to as the London patient underwent aggressive experimental treatment. He's been in remission for 19 months. This is now the second time that scientists have been able to essentially cure a patient who has the virus. The research is being presented at a major HIV/AIDS conference in Seattle today. Sarah Fidler and Richard Hayes are there. They're both HIV researchers from London. We wanted to know what the potential for a cure means to the 37 million people living with HIV and AIDS around the world.
it's an interesting way forward in that, you know, it makes us believe that it is a possibility that HIV could be cured. But this is my own personal feeling is that there is a lot more important work to be done in the field rather than just exploring this one quite intensive and aggressive treatment. You know, we've got to look at the scale of the HIV epidemic. You know, there's nearly 40 million people in the world living with HIV, and this is one man.
And Richard Hayes, how do you feel?
Yeah, well, like Sarah, I think this is interesting. Well, exciting, I think I would say, because it's certainly it's replicated what was seen was about 10 years ago when the Berlin patient was reported. So, you know, to have that finding replicated shows that it wasn't just a one-off. But that's a longer term strategy. And I think right now we need to focus on bringing down the incidence of HIV globally.
Sarah, maybe you can just give us a little context on what a cure would look like in the West.
So there's no doubt that a cure that could be more broadly applicable will involve antiretroviral therapy, which is what we have at the moment. But there may be additional tools that could either enhance the body's own immune system to try and target these sort of residual cells to get rid of them. And it may be that, the patients who go through these sort of different strategies may not be officially cured, as in you may be able to detect some virus still present, which incidentally at the moment is not the case with either the Berlin patient or this London case. So they are truly cured. But there is another approach that may confer what people are calling a remission, where we may be able to find virus in a blood test, but actually there's no virus circulating around the body, which means that that person's immune system will function and they, more importantly, are not also at risk of passing virus onto their partners.
Richard, you and your colleagues have conducted research in Zambia and South Africa that stresses prevention and treatment. I mean, it's not a cure, but do you feel that it is really like the reality of what needs to be focused on right now?
In theory, this is a very strong approach to bring down the number of new infections. What we've been doing is to test whether that can actually be delivered in practice in these very challenging environments in Southern Africa. And if it is possible, what effect does that actually have on the number of new HIV infections? The idea is that everyone in the whole community, and we're talking about communities with severe HIV epidemics in Southern Africa.
And what does that mean, severe?
Well, it means that up to 20% or more of adults have HIV, which is obviously an extremely high rate. Mm. So one person in five, you know, and a cure, to be honest, is going to be many years, I think, being developed. Meanwhile, we have this alternative approach, universal test and treat. The concept is to get them linked to the clinic where they are offered immediate antiretroviral therapy, ART.
What happened during the study? What did you find?
Yes, yeah, so we worked in 21 communities. These were urban communities in Zambia and South Africa. And in two of those groups, we provided a very intensive community-wide intervention where every house in the community was visited by our community health workers. And they visited every household in the community to offer HIV testing. And then they helped to link HIV-positive individuals to the clinic and help them to get onto ART, and importantly to stay on ART so that their virus would be suppressed. And you know, maybe I can ask Sarah to explain what we found in the trial in terms of the results.
Yeah, Sarah, can you explain that?
What we found at the end of the trial, which is what we are going to present tomorrow, is that the arms of the communities where they received our intervention, we saw a significant reduction in the number of new infections when we compared those infections with our control communities. But I think our key message is that we need to do a lot more to support people knowing how, if we can do that, this is one very key way of reducing the number of new cases. And we think this would be very relevant to many countries, but particularly those countries living with high rates of HIV in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, so a reduction, not a cure, and I don't want to obsess about this word cure, but I mean, is that combination intervention, are you hopeful that can lead to essentially an elimination of HIV?
Yes, I think it can work towards that. So remembering that, you know, there are nearly 2 million new infections a year, Even a 30% reduction on that would be, you know, several hundreds of thousands of people would be spared HIV infection. So we're talking about enormous numbers here.
What is the reality, though, for patients on the ground? Because the treatment and prevention path looks ideal from the outside, but there must be difficulties for patients that you've encountered.
Testing for HIV and living openly with HIV is highly stigmatized still. And just physically accessing care requires people often to take an entire morning or even a day off work. I mean, one of the things that we're very keen to do is look at how scalable this might be and, of course, whether it's cost effective. And providing treatment for people living with HIV is a lifelong requirement, and that sort of links together some of the things we've talked about. But that's why people are very interested in a cure for HIV. Because although the medicines for HIV are very, very effective, you do need to take them every single day for the rest of your life. And if you're a healthcare provider in a resource-limited setting where one in five of your population lives with HIV, that is an enormous burden in terms of provision of care as well as funding.
So what else do you want to see from cases like the London patient that will give you some more hope?
I mean, I also work as a clinician in the UK, and the London patient is a very interesting, and as Richard says, it's exciting and it's inspiring that this might happen, that it is actually possible to cure HIV. However, I think what we have learned from this case is we can understand a bit more detail about what it would require to make this into a more scalable approach. But I think we can learn from what we've seen in terms of the science of these kind of approaches that something that's less dramatic may well allow us to keep people well off antiretroviral therapy longer term.
Sarah Fidler and Richard Hayes, both researchers in London in HIV medicine, speaking with us from Seattle at the CROI 2019 Conference on HIV/AIDS. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still, there's reason to be hopeful with this news out of London. That's where we leave things today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.